Hey, everybody. Welcome to the very first edition of my new podcast, Spill the Wine. Welcome to my journalistic amateur hour. My name is Christoph Ellinghaus. I'm German. I live here in Berlin, but I'll be doing this in English, okay? I'm doing the interviews in a room above a wine bar here in the city, hence the name. And I'm going to talk with people who I think are interesting, or people who've done interesting things. Things that I find remarkable, things that interest me. And if you tune in and listen to me talking to these people, maybe you'll come away with something you didn't know before. I hope for interesting conversations. I hope I'm not going to be wasting your time. And at the end, you've been entertained. And at the end, you've been you know more than you did before. In real life, I run a record label. And so naturally, I'm going to be speaking to some musicians, some people that I work with, and I'm going to try and get their backstory. I'm going to find out what turns they've taken in their lives, but I'm not going to try and push anything on you or promote some of my own stuff. That would be kind of boring. Yeah, I mean, the fact that I'm doing this in English, you'll have to put up with my weird mix of whatever German, English, American accents. I apologize for that, but that's just the way it's going to be. And if you can't cope with it, then I'm sorry. But I hope it won't get in the way of the actual stuff I'm doing here. So let's get started. My very first chat, I met with the Scottish novelist and screenwriter John Niven. Interesting guy. He worked in the music industry in the 90s, and that inspired him to write his first novel, which was a hit novel, I suppose, called Kill Your Friends. In that, he created a character called Stephen Stelfox. He once called him a moral vacuum. I would call him a sexist, racist, misanthropic, and hugely cynical man of great greed and lies. He's also turning into a murderer, and he's just a hard-boiled record company A&R douchebag. So this whole book is really kind of over the top in its satirical tone, and it kind of remains devoid of any sentimentality throughout. John has released a total of 8 books, if I'm not completely mistaken, and he was recently in Berlin on a reading tour, and so I grabbed him and dragged him up into this room just to talk about himself and his books. His newest book is called No Good Deed, which is also an interesting story. A restaurant critic meets a bum in the streets of London, and it turns out that this is one of his oldest friends from back up in Scotland. And then a pretty interesting story develops from that meeting. Ultimately, their lives are turned upside down. He refers to that book by his German title because he's in promo mode and he's in Germany, so he calls it Alte Freunde, but the English title is No Good Deed. I think I've read a total of 4 of his books. In 2011, he published a book called The Second Coming. Again, really funny. Basically, it's about God up in heaven is kind of fed up with what mankind is doing on planet Earth, and he's sending down his son Jesus Christ to sort things out. And it's a John Niven book, so it goes awfully wrong, and Jesus ends up in all these hilarious situations, ultimately in a casting show in America, where Stephen Stelfox pops up again. That character shows up again. It's a really interesting read. John's an interesting character. He's very outspoken. His Twitter account is hilarious. He's well-read, very well-informed, very opinionated, and just an overall interesting character. He can probably be a wild man at some point, but here in this interview, he was on his best promo behavior and a total joy to listen to. He's a pro on the mic. And if you like that Scottish accent, you're in for a treat. So yeah, here it is. John Niven and me spilling the beans rather than wine. But we're above the wine bar. And yeah, I hope you'll enjoy the chat. Here we go.
I'll do my best, Christoph.
Just tell me a little bit about where you grew up?
Well, it was a new town, which in Scotland were, you know, built in the 60s. Well, it was originally a very small town that was expanded in the 60s, about 30 miles south of Glasgow. So, yeah, I grew up there, and ever since I could remember, when I was very small, I just couldn't wait to get out of that town. And then, you know, I left when I was 18, I guess, to go to Glasgow, to university.
And that was the big jump?
Yeah, well, I remember thinking Glasgow was like, you know, New York to me. It was like the huge metropolis. It was fantastic. But then I did what a lot of people do, and after maybe 4 or 5 years in Glasgow, I started to think, oh, I want to be in London.
Or they go back?
I was talking about this recently. I like going back to Glasgow for years because I've, you know, very fond memories of it. But for a long time, I didn't really like to go back to Ayrshire, where I'm from, because I didn't. And then just in the last 4 or 5 years, I've come to... The Welsh have an expression called hirath, which means a sort of, not quite homesickness, a sort of yearning for where you come from. And just in the last few years, I've started missing Ayrshire a bit. I mean, where I came from, there's like 10 fantastic world-class golf courses just and very close to each other. And, you know, golf's one of those things that was a passion of my father's that I learned from him when I was young. And then, like many people, I gave up in my sort of teens and 20s when I discovered punk rock and music, you know.
Yeah.
And then as I got into my 30s, I started getting back into golf, you know.
Yeah.
And now my son plays, and I kind of quite like going back there and playing golf and, you know. And also, I meet people who I knew at school who still live in the town.
Mm-hmm.
And part of me thinks, oh my God, how have you not killed yourself living here mm-hmm. for, the, you know, and never, you know, you think of when you move to big cities and all the different apartments you live in and all the adventures you have, and somebody's still, you know, 40 years later.
And they're in the same place.
Yeah. But at the same time, I recently look at them and think, well, you know what? Your life has probably been, it's really simple. If I'd lived there, I'd probably have a, you know, enormous house now, 5 minutes from the golf course, and you have no commuting. You drive, you know, you have no traffic jams. You've got no tube system. You get,
and
no.
Do you still have family up there?
Yeah. My mum.
Yeah.
My mum still lives there.
So you've got a reason to go.
I do.
And grandmother and all that. How old are your kids?
I got my daughter's 9. My son's now 21. So, it's fun to go back as a family.
Okay. So you made the jump to Glasgow. Is that where you discovered punk rock and all that stuff?
No, I kind of discovered punk rock in Irvine, and we're at Ayrshire, at home. Right. And, you know, when I remember it, to talk about being, it was sort of the mid 1980s mm-hmm. and to be a sort of indie kid in a small town, it was quite grim in some ways. But then when I look back now, me and all my friends had our own bands, and we would play it. We'd book local pubs and we'd do gigs, and friends did fanzines. It was actually quite an exciting, dynamic time.
What's your instrument?
I play guitar.
All right.
Mm.
Okay.
So yeah, until the age of 23, I thought I was going to be a rock star.
Oh, you did? Okay. Mm. Oh, so
yeah, but we we gave up on that one. Music's loss, might be
right.
Like, and then teacher's game.
And so, but then you went to study English literature.
Yeah.
In Glasgow.
Mm-hmm.
But then the detour happened to go to somehow. How did you end up in the music industry then?
Well, I did the first 2 years of my degree, and then I get asked to join a band called The Wishing Stones, who are based in London, mm-hmm. to play. We supported them in Glasgow, and they asked if I would play guitar for them. They'd fired their guitar player. And so age 19, I moved to London for 2 years, and we were in the band, and we made an album, and we toured, and, you know, it was all, you know, looking back now, we were never going to be U2, but it was great fun. You know, I was sort of 20, 21 years old and doing everything I'd wanted to do since I was sort of 14, touring and making records. The indie circles that we moved in were so small to us. A band like the House of Love, mm-hmm. like the Rolling Stones. You know, if we could be half as big as the House of Love, that would have been huge to us.
Right, yeah.
So it was fairly small goals. But that's kind of what indie culture was like in Britain in the 80s, pre-Stone Roses and pre-Oasis. Nobody thought about being big, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you could play to like a couple hundred people in each city, that was great, you know? So, but we did that for 2 years. And then I remember being at the London Marathon just as a spectator, and realizing that between four of us, we didn't have enough money to buy an ice cream. And I remember thinking, yeah, this is quite a difficult way of life. And at that point, I thought, I'm going to go back to university and finish my degree and try and get a real job.
Right,
so
right.
I went back to Glasgow.
Oh, so you did? You went back up?
I went back up. The 2 years in London when I was 19, 20, and then went back to university at 21. And I finished my degree. And sorry, to answer your question, so then I had a cousin who was, he, dance music was at its first big boom in the UK then, about 1991. Mm-hmm. And you could put out a 12-inch single and sell 5,000 copies without blinking, you know, which is very hard to do now. And he had a record shop in Glasgow, and he was wanting to start a record label. And he said to me, you've been in the band, you were signed to a record label, which we were. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, so you know how this stuff works, how you manufacture records and put them out. And I sort of lied and said, yeah, sure, yeah. And so the next thing I was working, we were running this little dance label, and we did very well. We didn't have like chart hits, but we put out a few records that were big club hits. And that sort of drew us into the orbit of some major labels who we started to meet with. And then after a couple of years, one of those major labels offered me a job to go and work for them.
Ah, okay.
So that's how, 1994, I wound up at London Records.
Slam was also from Glasgow.
Slam, we worked a lot with those guys. They did remixes for us. They're really, really great.
That's a pretty seminal Glasgow label, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, they were. Yeah, they really. Yeah. And those guys still DJ all the time, you know, they still make music.
So were you in that dance culture, the whole e-popping coming?
Yeah, I very much was, yeah.
24 hour.
Yep, for about, yeah, I guess for about the first half of the 90s, we were all very in that world.
Which was also very happening here in this city, of course.
Of course.
Yeah. Interesting. So then you moved back to London based on that job offer.
Yeah.
And you never, but did, when you decided I'm going to study English literature, what was the idea behind that?
It was the only grand plan behind that at the time was just to get out of the town. English was the subject I was best at school, so I just thought I'll do English.
You know, but were you writing anything anywhere at the time? Fanzine?
I started in my early 20s. I tried my first attempt to write a novel when I was about 21, just after I left the band and went back to start my degree. I wrote a couple hundred pages of a really bad novel, and then I tried another novel a few years later. And looking back now, I can see that I always kind of, part of me always knew, not even wanted to, part of me always knew that I was a writer. Mm-hmm. Just that sense of observation, detachment, and the kind of, funnily enough, in my 20s, I had a lot of the same ways of expressing myself, a similar turn of phrase to which I would eventually use in my novels. But I just had nothing to write about at age 22, 23. I hadn't lived enough. Mm. So it took sort of going through 10 years in the music industry to give me the experience that would eventually become Kill Your Friends, which sort of launched my career.
Yeah. You need to have something to turn into stories, I suppose.
Well, I think Nabokov said it best. He said that it's all very well to build oneself an ivory tower to write in, but first you have to take the unavoidable trouble of killing a few elephants. So to get the ivory, so you gotta go out and do stuff before you can, you know, hide yourself away and write about it.
So you did the music industry job or various jobs, I suppose.
I started in marketing and then moved into A&R.
Mm-hmm. And then when did it dawn on you that, I can turn this into a book? Oh, no, wait, there was Music from Big
Music
Pink.
From
Tell
Big
me
Pink
about
King
that.
For, well, that was,
Is
again...
Is the band important to you?
Yeah, I love their music. And it's just sometimes you have an idea for a story and then the practicalities of realizing it dictate what the book is. And when I worked in the music business, I had the idea for Big Pink around the same time as the idea for Kill Your Friends. Mm-hmm. So I guess I was about 34, 30, early 30s. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was still working in the music business at this point and very well paid and on the surface having a great life, but I wasn't very happy because I could see 40 on the horizon. And I thought, God, am I going to be one of those guys who ends up 40 and who never did what he wanted to do and jumps off a bridge? Or am I going to be that 40-year-old A&R guy with the bad leather jacket on at the back of the concert who doesn't?
No, 40 was a problem. I'm 40. Sure. In working in this music youth or turning 40, 30 is nothing.
Nothing. 40, you start to think, right?
You're dead weight.
I mean, there are guys I know who really love music and who still do it now, like Jeff Barrett and some of my friends who are heavenly, who are, you know, Lawrence at Domino, they're older than me and who love it.
But I'm doing it. I'm more than
and that's fantastic. Yeah. But I think in my heart, I thought I really knew that I wanted to be a writer and that I'd end up sort of unfulfilled if I didn't try.
Yeah.
And so what I did, I kind of had enough money to maybe live for a year, 2 years. Mm-hmm. And in my arrogance, I knew if I kept working in the music business and trying to write a little bit on the side, it might take me 5 years or 10 years and I'll be too old. So I thought, I'm just going to leave and try and write the great novel in 2 years. And in the end, it took about 4 years between leaving and getting published, and financially it got very difficult. But, you know, it was, thank God I did it. But the idea, so to come back to your question, for Music from Big Pink, is I met a lot of drug dealers, obviously in my time in the music business. And I thought it was kind of fascinating the way that these guys who are sort of 25, 26, that they, obviously, they're the first people in the dressing room after the show. They get on the private jet, they get in the limo, everybody's really happy to see them because they have the drugs.
Did you read this one book, Up and Down with the Rolling Stones?
To Tony Sanchez. Of course. I read everything in that sort of area. I didn't meet a lot of these guys who were like 45 and whose lives had turned out really happy and successful and well, who made a lot of money and then retired to a nice cottage with their family. That didn't seem to happen. These guys usually ended up either drug addicts or dead, or, you know, it wasn't a happy trajectory. So I thought that life arc was interesting, from the most popular guy in the room at 25 and hanging out with glamorous rock stars to sort of broken down drug addict in your 40s. Mm-hmm. I thought it might make an interesting novel. And then the problem is, to write a novel set in the music business, if you get it a bit wrong and you create a fake band to put it around, it can read so badly, like Rock Follies, you know, it can be
pastiche.
Yes, yeah. It can just, it's so easy to get it wrong. Yeah. So I had the idea, what if you set it around a real band in a real moment in time? And I'd always been fascinated by the band and Bob Dylan and that period in Woodstock. I'd read a lot about, and the received rock mythology is that they got off the road in 66 and they were up there going to bed at 9 o'clock at night. And of course, there's a bunch of rock and roll musicians in the early 20s. They were going crazy up there with booze and drugs. It's just that they weren't on tour. And so I started to read more about that period in Woodstock and, you know, the amount of local girls that got pregnant and all the parties they had. And I thought, well, this is a fascinating contained little world to set a story in. And so I used that to weld the idea about this drug dealer's life into this, which is how the book came about.
But it hadn't been published for a while, right? It only came, did it come out after?
It came out in Germany much later, but it was published in America for a very small publisher, Continuum, and it was published in 2004.
And these people have diehard fans.
Yeah.
Did you get death threats?
Yes, I got a lot of grief on the internet from diehard fan. How dare you? You know, but the good news for me as a writer is the two band guys I wanted to write about most, Richard Manuel and Rick Danko, were both dead. So you could kind of go where you wanted there.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. I did get some grief for it. But I thought I wrote it for, I think I wrote that novel for $3,000 for like a year of my life. So it was, but in the back of my head, I thought, I already had the idea for Kill Your Friends, and I thought if the book gets good reviews, I might get an agent out of it, and then we can try with the next book. And that's exactly, we got a fantastic review in the New York Times review of books, and then my agent, Claire Conville, who's still my agent today, read it, and she signed me in 2005, so 12 years ago. And then, hitting the table.
Thanks.
Yeah, so we went from there to shopping around Kill Your Friends when I'd written, I think I wrote maybe I wrote three chapters of Kill Your Friends, and which are pretty similar to the ones that are in the book. And she read it and she said, wow, this is not going to be an easy sell.
Mm.
But, if we can get somebody to publish it, I think we could have a lot of success here. And we were turned down, I think, by 17 or 18 publishers
in the UK.
Yeah. Wow. And then I was at that point, cause I was 38, 39. I almost was 40. And I was thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do?
And you had family.
Yeah. I had a son at that point. And I thought, I'm going to end up either, I don't know, a teacher or, you know, I had a plan that if everything went wrong, I was going to run away and join the Royal Air Force. Because when I was a little tiny kid, my dad was in the RAF.
At 38?
Well, they will take you for officer training up until you're 40.
Okay.
So my plan was I'd wait till I'm 39, and if nothing worked out, I was just going to run away and join the Air Force.
And you were going to be a pilot? Or?
Well, I probably couldn't be a pilot because my maths is terrible, but I'm, you know, whatever. This was my backup plan.
Okay.
But thankfully, at the last minute, Random House came in with a very nice offer to publish the book. So
you had the choice between Steve Stelfox and the Army. Wow.
Yeah, it was a tough choice.
Steve did you good.
Yeah, he's a son of a bitch, but I owe him a lot.
Was it? And so the book came out. I remember the German publishers, they sent it to me in German translation, loose.
They
wanted to get a quote for the back. I was like, I read half of it and I was like, I can't read this in German. I'd love to read this in English. and then I came around much later to actually read it in English.
Uh-huh.
And then I saw the film. When did that film come out? I think I saw it on an airplane.
The film came out 3 years ago.
Yeah. I think I saw it on an airplane. And you wrote the screen for that too. How, did you find that much different? And is this a British production?
Look, it's difficult in the way that indie films are always difficult. The budget was like £2.5 million. And there's always things that could have been a lot better that just due to the pressures of time and budget, you know?
That's not very much at all for a film like that.
But it's so hard to get anything made now that's not a superhero movie or a sequel or anything that's kind of different is very difficult, you know? Even when if you've got big actors in it, you know, people struggle to get their projects made all the time. So it's, but you know, with movies, it's, you know, it's funny when you do things like this and you do interviews and people, you can tell some people don't like the film and they're trying to get you to say it, but I can see its flaws, but I think everybody really, it's got its own kind of, it works in a way that's different from the book. And I always think anyway that if a bad movie was made of a book I love, it doesn't detract from the book. The book's still the same thing. Yeah. It's intact, isn't it?
There was a few things where I was scared of for the film, and that was, for instance, Rudy. I loved that. Oh, the whole medium in the book.
Moritz
was just perfect.
Is one of the best things in the movie. I remember when we filmed that scene, he was so in character. We're doing it at a hotel in London and he was literally eating the scenery. He was just going berserk. And it was so extreme. In the room, it looked so extreme to me. I thought, this is never going to work. He's just going too crazy. But when you see the movie, and when you see the movie with a big audience, I saw it in Toronto Film Festival and also here in Berlin, I think, at the film festival. And that scene when he comes on, it's the first time the film really lifts off. And people, you know, he's an amazing actor. I couldn't say enough about working with him. He was fantastic. But I also hold the view that when you take the check to have a movie made of one of your books, then you should, you know, you shouldn't slag the product off. I know I could sit here and go, well, I've done this differently and that differently. I think everyone involved did a great job with the result.
One last question about the film, because I think the end credit, and that was like produced by Len Blavatnik.
Yeah.
Now, this is like one of the richest
guys in the world,
one of the richest people in the world.
Yeah.
It didn't say executive, it said produced, but was he actually...
He put all the money up. I think he put about 80% of the money, most of the money. He'd bought Warner Brothers at that point, you know, he's a billionaire, you know, and I think he loved the book and he just wanted to...
Was he personally involved?
We met a couple of times and, at parties, he wasn't on the set day to day, but he put the money. God bless him. If he hadn't put the money up, the film wouldn't exist. So he did what a producer should
do. He's now a Trump supporter and all that, right?
You know what? I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. He's a kind of he's a scary dude.
Heavy donator for the Republican Party, and then moved on to. I think he financed the inauguration, something.
Really? Yeah. I would believe almost anything on that front.
Scary.
Yeah.
So then the Amateurs I read, and I read it in Scottish because there was no English. I had a really hard time.
That's a difficult read if Scottish isn't your first language.
But I was, I'm one of the few people I know that who get really excited, by golf on telly. My wife, my wife will walk by and go, "What?" And you're like, "This is pure suspense."
Yeah.
So when I saw there was a golf and crime novel by you, I had to go and get it. And I've enjoyed that very much, but it's quite a while ago that I read that.
Yeah. It's about 10 years ago now that came out. Yeah.
The new one I read in quite basically one sitting. Uh-huh. Yeah. It was just, but I had the joy to read The Second Coming, right? Mm-hmm. Like a couple of weeks ago.
And, oh, wow.
And I was, and that was, I think the way you've been moving from, I mean, you know, Kill Your Friends was just so spiteful and so, you know, and so ugly. You were really ugly in there. And, yeah. And with, you had completely changed the tone. I mean, and you bring the character back only as a game show tycoon. Uh-huh. Steven Stelfox all of a sudden is the Simon Fuller in that book in the US.
Very much.
But the overall, there was a different moral, moral concern, ethical concern, but so well done. I liked that about that book, that you were just addressing all these things from that distant view.
That book was very remarkably successful in Germany.
Yeah.
I think much more so than all my other novels. It outsold them by a significant margin. I think Germany was the biggest performing territory in the world for that book. We did quite well. Fun enough, we did quite well in Italy too. Uh-huh. And okay in the UK, and we didn't get published in America. My publishers dropped me.
Oh, because of that book?
I think so.
And then consequently, the next books?
After that, I think Straight White Male came out in America.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the last one. So like a lot of British writers, yeah, it's very difficult in America. You know, they don't...
Wow.
Outside of certain genre things, they don't go nuts for a lot of fiction that's not homegrown. It's very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of, you know, very successful British novelists you could name who've never sold anything in America. But on Second Coming, I think it was difficult that they, you know, you don't want to get too conspiracy theorist on it, but it was HarperCollins, who are my publishers, mm-hmm. who are owned by News Corp. And the book, it just took after I submitted it, we just expected it would be published routinely, and then they took a long time to respond to the manuscript. And my editor said something to my British agent, like, just tell John that I'm behind him. And I was like, wait, what do you mean? What's the problem here? And then after a long time, they turned around and said, no, we decided we're not going to. We don't think John's last book did well enough to merit putting this out. Because they put out Kill Your Friends and The Amateurs, mm-hmm. and they published both of them. And I really think it was the religion thing. You know, religion in America is still a very hot button topic, you know?
And you're putting it in the book, it's the way you're displaying it, the bigotry, or what's the word? I mean, when you, when they pick up the kid on the road trip who just got stoned or, you know, outside the...
Well, there was a lot of things in it, and... Well, if you dig into it, like, you find out that News Corp, who owned HarperCollins, they fund a lot of pro-life groups and things like that. And it's a whole, you know, pro-abortion thing in the book. And there's all that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So you wonder, you know? But if you'd asked me when I was writing the novel, because it's set in America, where you thought it'd be successful, I'd have said, yeah, for sure in America. And I thought we wouldn't get published in Italy because it's it's a very Catholic country.
Yeah.
And then the book did great in Italy, because you forget that Italians, while they're religious, they're also very cynical about the church.
Yeah.
Because they've seen the corruption of the Vatican for so long, you know, so they don't mind you poking fun at that because they get it, you know?
When I read it, I thought the entire time, this is screaming to be a movie. I thought that would have been an even more exciting movie.
Funny you say that, because it began life as a movie. I wrote the first 70 pages as a screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got to 70 pages and I thought, this is insane. No studio is ever going to, because it was all, the whole section that's set in heaven.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is, it's going to be CGI. It's going to be, going to cost a lot of money to do.
A board meeting in heaven.
So yeah, it's not cheap. And I suddenly thought, this will never get made, you know, and the thought of spending a year of my life more writing it and never getting the movie made. I just thought, you know what? I'll do it as a novel and then hopefully maybe one day it'll become a movie. And it's the only one of my books that is currently not optioned for a movie.
Oh.
Which is, well, we came a few, like all these Hollywood stories, you have meetings and you think something's going to happen, it never does. But I met a director a few years ago who had just worked with George Clooney on something. And he knew, I think he'd read an interview where I'd said that I could picture George Clooney playing God in the novel.
Okay.
And he said, I've got a good relationship with George, I'm doing another movie with him, I'd like to get him to read the book, and if he attaches to do it and the studio approved me, we might have a, you know, fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Go.
And then, of course, never heard anything.
Right.
Sure, George Clooney read the book and said, this guy's insane.
Maybe a bit outside of his wheelhouse.
Possibly, yeah.
All right, back on. So I want to talk about the process a bit, about the sort of technicalities. When you collect these ideas, when these ideas come to you and you're going to, this can turn into a story. How do you have a notebook where you go first the ideas and then develop them, or how do you?
I do have a notebook, but when I review my notebook, it's always full of, usually when I'm drunk, if I know it's something like man meets Martian and imports space dust, which is some really stupid, you know, which I tend to find that if I have a really good idea, it'll come into my head a second time and then a third time and it won't go, you know.
Yeah.
In the end, I think the novels you write are the ones that are in you in a way that you can't get away from, you know, the idea will recur to you, you know.
Yeah. So when you're at the begin, sorry for interrupting, when you sit down with the idea, finally, this one is coming back to me, how far is it into, because at first it's probably just a core little idea, all right,
yeah.
I'm going to bring Jesus back.
Yeah.
And then you have to sort of build an entire world around that.
Correct, yeah. That's exactly, you've just described exactly how it happens. Sorry. Again, Nabokov described it as a throb, just a tiny throb in the back of your head that grows until finally you think, yeah, I can write a book about this. Well, to give you an example, with the new novel, Alter Freunde, that was an incident that happened to me maybe 20 years ago when I was working in the music business.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to a meeting in London and it was winter, very cold, and I was going down an alleyway in Soho and I saw him, I heard a voice say, hi, John. And I turned around and there was a guy lying in the street eating some, like a kebab sort of thing. And I thought, how does he know my name? And then as he started to talk to me, I realized it was a guy from back home who I had known when we were teenagers. And I thought, God, he's a tramp, because he was just lying in the street eating food. And sort of two thoughts went through. I should say, it wasn't a guy I ever really liked. So part of me thought, oh, that's fantastic. There's a Schadenfreude thing going, fantastic, he's a tramp. But another part of me thought, oh, my God, how did this happen? And we stood there and we talked for a bit. And I was thinking, should I give him some money? You know, I thought, will he be offended if I give him money? Because we know each other, but surely he probably wants the money. So I was about to give him some cash when I noticed there was construction, building work going on across the street. And then next to him, what I thought was like his tramp's bundle was actually tools. And I realized he was working on this job. That's what he did. And I was this close to sort of saying, you're a tramp, here's a couple of pounds, you know? So thank God I didn't say that to him. But for some reason, that incident, I mean, this was a tiny incident over 20 years ago, but it just stuck in my head all these years. So then eventually you do the what if, that's your basic premise. And so my what if was, well, what if I was a slightly nicer person than I am in real life and I bumped into someone like that and my instinct wasn't to mock them. It was like, let's get you off the streets, come and live with me and I'll try and help you rebuild your life, you know?
Right.
So that became the what if, and then it becomes a kind of how, and then much later kind of, there's the initial setup of, you know, what if, and then there's the how, and then much later there's why, which becomes thematics. Why am I writing about this? What is it? What is it about this subject that really interests me?
So is that all happening at a desk with notes, or is that still on the couch?
A lot of it happens in this. Your subconscious does a lot of the heavy work. You know, there'll be things that, for me, writing the first draft of a book is just trying to get the basic narrative arc banged out, the story of where they go.
Ah, okay. So you do that. You do a draft.
Yeah.
This is like without overdubs.
Yeah, correct. Okay. I write three drafts. I mean, I know some novelists who only do one, but they probably take a whole day to write one or two pages. But when they're done, you could take it to the printers. My first drafts are awful. You know, they're very rudimentary and full of lazy description and cliche, and I have to really work and refine them. But once I get that first draft, once I know that there's a story there, and I try to write it fast, you know, 3 months at the most, because you're trying to keep it alive and fresh and moving. Then it's a case of rewriting the second draft. And my first drafts are normally quite skeletal, maybe 70,000 words, which is about 250 pages. And usually on the next draft, it'll expand a bit to 80, 90, 300, 400 pages. And then you trim it back a little in the third draft. But, you know, it's the subconscious thing. Sometimes you kind of, you'll know that there's something that's not quite working about it, or that you don't know quite where you're going to go next. And then you'll just be in the shower or driving the car, and suddenly you won't even know that you've been thinking about it, but the answer will pop into your head, you know, because somewhere you've been, you know.
Yeah, we have a drill somewhere here. I don't know where it is, but it's annoying. It's coming through a little bit on the recordings. I'm hoping we're going to be fine. So do you have some sort of work regime that you put yourself under, as in, okay, I've got to, I have a 9-to-5, or I do, is there a routine?
I mean, no, don't put me, I like to work in the mornings. It's something I've learned as I got older, that I'm more of a morning person than I thought I was.
Okay.
So normally I write from breakfast till about lunchtime, so from 8-9 a.m. until about 1 o'clock. The most, you know. I think any novelist, if you get two very good hours of work, two concentrated hours a day is the bare minimum. But I don't stop till I've got a couple of thousand, 2,000 words normally in a day.
We are on Alte Freunde, or No Good Deed, as it is called in English. You created another jaded cynic, a restaurant.
Critic, yeah.
Critic. But again, so I had read the Second Coming and all this. And when you go from Kill Your Friends from the spiteful, you know, just horrible person back then to this is, you're describing, somebody in a very sophisticated sort of arrived middle aged situation. And you're matching that off with the bum, who in your case wasn't a tramp. He was a worker who took a break. But it's great. So 20 years ago that happened, and this just became the throb.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So how long did it take you from sort of, was that a 3 months kind of process?
The whole book normally takes me about a year.
Oh, wow.
Because
okay.
3 months to write the first draft. But then what I do is I'll put it in a drawer for at least 2 months. So then when you return to it, it's like you're reading it for the first time, you know? So, and then a couple of months for the second draft. So you're up to about sort of 6 or 7 months there. And then I'll do a polish, a third draft. And then my editor, my agent will read it, and you get some feedback. And that'll take a little while. And then you'll do another draft. So beginning to end, normally around a year, you know? Although I have interruptions now because I have to go off and write movies. I do screenwriting in LA.
Okay.
So yeah, you'll be off and you'll do another project and then come back to the book. So I admire the sort of genre novelists who write a book every year. You know, I think I've written 8 novels in 10 years.
Oh, that's pretty good.
It's not bad, but it's not quite a book a year. But some of these guys, like, every year, you know.
Oh, how much screenwriting do you do?
Usually we've got 3 or 4 projects a year.
So that's got to be a big distraction?
It's not a distraction so much. It's good. It's being a novelist is a very lonely job. You know, it's just you in the desk for a year and a half at a time. Whereas when you write screenplays, I do them with a partner, my partner Nick. mainly. So it's like going to the office and you get to meet someone else, and you also, you have to have meetings with the producers of the studio and your manager. So it's a bit more communal, you know?
Yeah.
Often I make the analogy that being a novelist is a bit like being a private eye. You're on your own and you're sort of figuring out clues, and it's the scotch bottle and the slatted blinds late at night. Whereas being a screenwriter is more like being a cop. You go to the state, you go to the cop station and you meet the other cops, and you all have donuts and coffee together, and it's a bit more, you know.
Okay. But so when you publish a book, then you also have to go on these trips, right? Mm-hmm. Do you have, is Germany can't be the only place where you go to?
We do Italy, we do Germany, we do the UK, less in America now and again.
So that'll eat up a lot of time, no?
Well, it does. These are just all the distractions that sort of come with having some success, you know? Not that I'm not happy to do it. It's always fun to meet your readers and to go and, you know, but it does, it does eat into the time at the desk, you know? I was seeing recently how when I was writing The Amateurs, all I had to do back then was write one book every year, and there weren't so many interview requests and there wasn't all the screenwriting. So it was, you know, I would write for 4 hours in the morning and go and play golf every day. I think I got my handicap down to about 10.4 at that point, which is the lowest it's ever been. Mm. But I was playing every day, you know? It's going to do it to you. But no, I can't complain because I get paid very nicely to do work that I love, you know, so you can't, you know. If you told me 15 years ago when I left the music industry that it would work out like this, then I said, you're crazy.
So I have a question about Craig, because Craig starts taking notes about the lifestyle once he has moved into the house, and it becomes very apparent very early on, okay, something is going to happen. It doesn't quite become as apparent that they actually trade places and that he's out to ruin his life. And also the incident, the toilet flush incident at his in-law's house. I didn't connect those to Craig, even though I should have. And so later on in the sort of when they recap, you're like, oh yeah, of course he did that too. But did you plan on giving that up quite so early that this guy is obviously plotting something?
It's very interesting that you ask me that question, because in my original draft, there was one tiny hint, I think, that he was maybe up to something. And it was my editor and I think agent both said it might be better if you have a few hints just for the tension, you know, for the reader to be thinking, what is he up to? You know, my instinct was just to hide it completely so that it comes as a complete surprise, you know? And it's funny because it was a note that you've asked about there. It was a note that came back and I kind of thought, okay, I can see that. So I put a couple more in and made it a little bit clearer that he's up to something. And I'm still not sure, it might not have been better to do what I intended to do. But then again, I have met a couple of readers who have said that they found it a really tense book to read because they knew he was out to ruin him, but you didn't quite know how it was going to happen, and he had no idea. So they found it, which is a good thing, you know?
Yeah.
So
the tension is definitely there. The tension might have actually also been there without
signposting it.
Those hints.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a difficult thing to gauge sometimes. And it's quite rare to get a note like that. And I mean, in the movie industry, you get that all the time. I mean, they've got no compunction about saying, lose this entire character, rewrite this entire, you know, they don't care. Whereas it's rare for an editor to give you a sort of strongish note with that.
So you think that's a respect thing? That when you write a novel, when you're a novelist, I don't talk to you like you're a screenwriter.
No,
you're doing your
job. I think the publishing industry is much more respectful than the film industry, you know? Mm-hmm. In the film industry, they'll just fire you. If you won't do what you like, they'll just literally fire you. It'd be harder to fire me and get a book with John Niven's name on it at the end. That wouldn't really work. But in Hollywood, nobody ever took their girlfriend to see a movie because of who wrote it.
No, that's also
so you
true.
Know it's they're a bit more ruthless out there.
Yeah, I guess you work in two very similar but quite different industries there.
Yeah, it's I think William Goldman, who wrote Marathon Man and, you know, All the President's Men and Misery, one of the biggest screenwriters in Hollywood. He was also a novelist. And he said that if all you do is write screenplays for a living, I might covet your bank balance, but I wouldn't give you 50 cents for your soul. Because it's a very soul destroying, you know, it's Hollywood's art by committee.
Yeah. It's,
which can often be frustrating for those of us who are truly creative, you know. As Woody Allen said that, you know, when you're a writer in Hollywood, you have to have all these meetings and lunches and breakfasts and that, and it just gets in the way of what you want to do is just write. You just want to write the movie.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of people who work in the industry who can't, they can't write the movie, but what they can do is have lunches and dinners and meetings because then they feel that they're doing their job.
Oh, yeah.
So their job is actually the thing that just gets in the way of you doing your job. Right.
So what have you written over there or for Hollywood? Is that a secret?
No, well, we do a lot of the work we do is uncredited. It's like, you know, they've got a
really
movie. Yeah, which is the best way to work because some of these movies you wouldn't necessarily
want to lift a secret here.
We're working on one right now, but I can't really say. It's quite a big act, it's quite a famous actor. And it's like an action comedy sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's frustrating because some of the original script to this was probably quite good. And then what happened is they suddenly wanted to make one of the lead parts female. But I guess because of famous actress, student interest. Mm-hmm. And then that necessitates a lot more work than these people think because you change a main character from a man to a woman. It's a huge perspective shift. And
that's because of, based on research?
Based on casting usually.
Yeah.
Some hot actress has read the script and said, I quite like to play that part. And the whole game is if you get a big enough name, then your movie gets a green light.
Right.
So then you'll end up with a script like the one we got, which has already been rewritten a couple of times and it doesn't work anymore because, and then you have to sort of unify the voice of it and fix the whole thing up. So they spend a lot of money doing this and, you know, sometimes it produces great results. A lot of the movies in history that you probably love have probably been rewritten, you know, loads of times.
Right.
And it's a very creative, I've come to understand that to make a really good movie is such a difficult thing. So many things have to go right. Everything has to go right. It's amazing that so many, that every film isn't bad. It's such a difficult thing to get right, you know?
Yeah, that's a good one. It's amazing that every film isn't bad. Ooh. Some come through on the other side.
They do, you know. I'm sure there's more great films in the world than there's any right to be.
Yeah. All right. Interesting screenwriting. So I have one last question. Scotland, you know, Catalonia.
Oh, wow.
but then there's the larger problem called Brexit. Where are we going? Where's this all headed? Do you have any idea? I have to ask you, you're from
No, I think we are literally living in the age of the moron right now. The moron has been heard.
But the moron is leading us.
Yeah, that's what I mean. They've decided that no knowledge is as good as all the knowledge, that ignorance is every bit as worthwhile as, you know, education, that the Trump and then Brexit, it was a devastating year politically, I think, for MD with half a brain. I couldn't believe it.
Absolutely.
You know? Especially in the UK with Brexit, we have the government's own figures. Every conceivable economic person that you'd listen to saying this is going to be a disaster for the people of Britain. Yeah. And a lot of them still want, the lunatics who voted for it still want to do it. So I don't know what you do in that situation where you've, you know, you've explained to people this is going to, because a lot, personally, I got a huge pay hike out of Brexit so far because, you know, the pound collapsed. I earn quite a lot of money in America and in Europe. Mm. So suddenly with the exchange rate, you know, I probably gained.
Oh, you're benefiting from it.
Well, I did, but I still 100 times to my last breath would vote against it.
Yeah.
Because you know what? I'm fine. I make a very good living, but it's the people out there who, you know, who's go to the supermarket and their shopping bill is going to increase by 30% and they have to live on like £100 a week. These people are going to be really struggling, you know? Mm-hmm. As against that, on the other hand, sometimes I think, well, nobody knows what's going to happen. It's terrifying. Nobody's got any idea. It might be not that bad, but I tend to suspect it's going to trigger a real recession in Britain, you know?
God, I hope not.
And it's going to be the poorest people who suffer because they bought a load of lies off a bunch of people who are going to benefit from it. I mean, Nigel Farage and a lot of these Tory politicians, they're directly going to financially benefit from this. Same with Trump and his cabal in America.
They will directly financially benefit?
Well, Farage is like hugely, you know, tied to the city and he's got, you know, you hear stories of all sorts of currency deals.
But isn't the city taking a beating? Aren't these companies moving out?
They'll all make a fortune. Whenever there's sort of drastic change like that, these guys always make a fortune. It's the people at the bottom of the heap that are going to. And also the whole sort of, you know, when you get into these arguments, and I get into quite a few of them on Twitter with the sort of Trump, whether it's Trump supporters in America or Brexit people here, and I'm at the end of being polite about it. For a long time, the polite middle class thing to do was to say, well, you know, there are a lot of people who were left behind economically and, you know, they made their voice heard. I'm like, no, fuck that. I'm sort of past that now. I'm thinking these people are literally racists and morons, 80% of them at this point. So I'm done caring what they think I want because all they want is to be able to say no immigrants and fuck the rest of you.
Okay.
As somebody very cleverly said actually on Twitter, 40 or 50 years ago, whoever is writing the screenplay for Planet Earth is doing an amazing job because nobody saw a third act climax coming where Germany gets to save the world from American fascism.
Yeah, it seems odd.
It wasn't a conclusion that then they saw coming.
But I'm not now. Germany can't get a government together.
Is this going to be bad?
Well, you don't. You know, some people I think look at Germany for a bit of stability.
Yeah, God,
in this context, and.
Because I thought Merkel was good. I thought they should.
Well, but she needs to find a coalition. And there are people, because the right is rising. So there's people inside her, like little sister party in Munich, who want to be, you know, beat out the right by taking on their arguments. And, you know, so all the refugee thing is a big issue between the parties.
Oh,
and so that's what they're discussing. And so trying to find common ground with the Green Party. And Merkel has adopted all of the green issues. She's shut down the nuclear power in Germany after Fukushima, which is like, you know, the Christian Democrats were never, I mean, that was completely, what is she doing? And then she opened she became this ace humanitarian in 2015 with the refugee crisis. Just let them in. We can deal with this. And she got under so much, she got so much flack for that. And so this is the key. This had led to a new sort of political force, populist force rising on the right. And this is what they're trying to fight against. And so people aren't, you know, it's complicated.
I'd been holding Germany up as a sort of beacon on that stuff for a while. And I was hoping that this right-wing populism that sort of...
But the same stuff that happens elsewhere is happening here. The gap is widening, you know, the age of the moron is sort of the... they're still hard at work keeping people from education, you know, and that's the key, you know.
Well, the other thing, I don't know if you guys have this here, but the extent of Russian influence that's becoming apparent on social media, you know, in Britain now, I think there's traced something with 3,000 Twitter accounts that sent maybe 150,000 messages in the weeks leading up to the Brexit vote, which were all traced directly to St. Petersburg, to the coal factory. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
This isn't some conspiracy theory?
It's in the Guardian, the Times, the Daily Mail, everywhere. Twitter have done it. Twitter have said, yeah, these accounts came from St. Petersburg.
Wow.
Russia, all masquerading as either... you know, pro-Brexit, or a lot of them in America saying that they're Trump supporters. No, the accounts are actually based in St. Petersburg. This isn't like some crazy left-wing paper saying. The Daily Mail ran a huge story, which is as right-wing a paper as you get in England. It's a real thing. But now people are saying, in America, the Trump hardcore are saying, you know what, even if Russia did help get him elected, who cares?
Yeah,
we love him. They don't care.
Yeah.
This is the age of lunacy we're in, you know?
I just wonder what the Russian destabilization, or what's the...
Yeah, well, Putin is an expansionist. Mm-hmm. He's openly said he wants to expand his empire. And the only way he's going to be able to pick off the East European states and get this to happen is if he completely destabilizes NATO. His two main foes were the USA and the EU. and he's almost in the verge. If Germany sort of goes to the right, he'll have completely splintered the EU. Mm-hmm. Britain, he'll have had a hand in
that.
Well,
you already have Poland and Hungary and all of that going
on. And then America, he'll have helped get. Trump's openly said, you know, we're not going to be the world's policeman anymore. And this is all music to Putin's ear. And, you know, it's not even about, you say Putin's political ambitions. All he is about is cash. It's just money. All he wants is expansion. It'll be pipelines. It'll be oil. Ukraine. It's just all. But he's the world's richest man by a country mile. It's not known because it's all hidden. But he's a genuinely terrifying figure, and it's his world now. He's on the verge of having it all. Anyway, on that note,
thank you for the chat. Well, thanks so much for coming in here.
Thank you for having me. Cheers, Christoph.
All right. All right, there you have it. My first interview. Man, was I nervous. My palms were sweaty. I was shaking. I had no idea how to work the microphone. I didn't know really how to signal to the other person not to pound his fist on the table, because the mix, obviously, they're picking that up as well. This is all new stuff to me, so thank God one of us was professional. John Niven, what a guy. You should read his books, or you should follow him on Twitter. I guess we got a little political there in the end. And of course, at the time when we were doing this interview, our Chancellor Angela Merkel was still trying to put together a three-party coalition here in Germany. Well, now we know that didn't work out, and Germany still doesn't have a new government, but that's okay. They'll get there in the end, I suppose. Anyways, that was it. The humble beginnings of my Spill the Wine podcast. If you want to get in touch with words of critique or encouragement, don't send me hate. I don't need that shit. Just feel free to do so. Go to the website spillthe.wine. Yes, that's a domain ending now. Wine. .wine is like .com. I couldn't believe it either. So spill the is the beginning, .wine is the end. Check it out. And thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you come back for more.